From JetBooks, this is Irish Business Builders, a show about great Irish businesses and the people who built them.
Learn from the past, but don't keep reflecting on the past, if you know what I mean. You've got to always look forward and learn from your mistakes. And to me, most people in business have made mistakes. Some will acknowledge them, others won't.
I'm Conor Carney, and that's the voice of Mick Carney, who could be described as a serial entrepreneur, bringing not one, but two successful franchises to Ireland since starting out in business in the early 1980s. Mick landed in his first venture, Snap Printing, almost accidentally while working abroad in Australia. As we discussed early in the interview, Mick became the master franchise holder for Snap in Ireland in 1984, which quickly grew to be the largest print and design group in the country. Then, in 2005, Mick and his business partner Ed Murphy launched another franchise in Ireland, Home Instead Senior Care, which provides a more dignified alternative to older people who may need assistance but do not want to live in a nursing home. Mick also managed to find time to become manager of the Irish rugby team, a position he held passionately and successfully for 5 years, alongside colleagues Declan Kidney and later Joe Schmidt. He talks about his early days in business, the importance of learning to sell, and how he dealt with the stress after losing everything in the dot-com crash in 2001. Mick started off our chat by telling me the story of his early career and how he got involved with Snap Printing.
So I went to school in Castleknock College, and I came from a farming stroke cattle dealing background. And I think from the time I was probably 7 or 8 years of age, there was an understanding that I would actually end up going into the family business. I thought right through Castleknock, my main kind of focus was probably more on sport than it was on the books. So I came out of Castleknock. I then worked with my dad for 6 years in the family business, which effectively was cattle dealing and farming, going around the country, driving probably 50,000 miles as there were back then every year, buying and selling cattle. Did that from really a year in agricultural college after school, and then did that for 5 years post that. And I think like a lot of farmers and eldest sons, the relationship was probably a little bit difficult, I would say. As a result of that, we decided in 1981, 1982, that really my future didn't lie in working, I think, with my dad, number one, and in the whole kind of cattle business area, number two. We decided that we'd emigrate to Australia, so it was a massive move. I didn't have any college education as such, so I wasn't sure, I suppose, what I was qualified to do apart from probably buy and sell. And really, I think when you learn to buy and sell, you can fit into a lot of different businesses and jobs. So my wife Eugenie was a nurse, so she got a job in Royal Perth Hospital pretty well straight away. I got a couple of jobs in selling advertising space and a couple of, I suppose you'd call them really commission-based, kind of not high-end jobs as such. And then I got involved in a rugby club in Perth called Cottesloe Rugby Club, and through that I met a man called Paddy Thompson. Paddy was CEO of a company called Snap Printing at the time, and got chatting to Paddy, and Paddy offered me a job effectively going in at the bottom rung of the ladder, learning how to print, getting a position in one of the centres in Perth in Western Australia. And this was probably March, April 1982. So I started working for Snap, worked away with Snap for about 18 months, worked my way up to centre manager level, had the opportunity to buy the master franchise for Snap for Ireland. So Paddy, who was originally from Mount Melling, County Leash, Paddy actually came back to Ireland on a family holiday, came back to Australia, and he said, "Mick, don't touch Ireland," he said. "It's a basket case." He said, "Unemployment is 16-17%, interest rates are the same, it's a deep recession." He said, "Go to Queensland, go to the Gold Coast, open up there." We came back with the view just to have a look at the market with the absolute intention of going back to Australia and opening up the first Snap outlet on the Gold Coast in Australia. Came back and decided that we were going to go to Queensland. Eugenie went to her dad, she's the eldest of 12 children, went to her dad to tell him the bad news that we were actually going back to Australia, that we weren't going to open up in Ireland. He started to cry, and it was on that basis that we made the decision to actually stay in Ireland. So when you talk about due diligence and business planning and all that, this decision to buy the master franchise for Snap in Ireland was made purely on emotion. It wasn't based on anything other than emotion and a little bit of market research. So that's how I ended up owning the master franchise for Snap Ireland.
Snap obviously became a success quite quickly in Ireland. Given all the things that were wrong with the economy and that were wrong and that no kind of real planning was done, it was an emotional decision. What do you think it was that helped the business and you in the first few years?
I think the biggest thing was probably a fear of failure. We had one child when we came back from Australia. We had another one on the way. Whatever money I had into Snap, and I knew that if this didn't work, I didn't know what was going to happen. So I actually had to make it work. I didn't have any option, and I suppose fear of failure is, it's one of the aspects of life, aspects of business that's probably driven me pretty well right up to this day. And I think it's a very good thing to have when you open a business, because if you're at the pin of your collar to succeed, well then you just don't have any other option. So failure was not an option here. We had to make it succeed. So worked hard. Again, I think hard work is probably very underestimated in terms of a talent. So worked really, really hard, probably right up to the time I retired a couple of years ago. So hard work was an important part of it. I used my contacts. In particular, there was a guy, Robbie Keller, who was the chief economist in Davy Stockbrokers. And Robbie gave me a call one day, and I got a couple of jobs from him. And they were monthly jobs. They repeated every month. And it was manna from heaven. It was like somebody handed me winning the lotto almost. Mm-hmm. Like, it was just fantastic. Because I knew then I had these couple of jobs every single month, and they pretty well paid the rent, so I knew I was on the right road. So first 6 months were hard, like they are in every business. To say you don't make money for 2 years, we actually made money about 3-4 months into our first year, and we made money every single month from then on in, and it became a really kind of big success, probably bigger than I thought it would become. We ended up with a lot of really good franchise owners. I think at its height, Snap had about 24 centres in Ireland. It's now down to, I think, 16, 17, but still very successful. Still probably Ireland's number one digital print design promotion products signage group. And it's great to see that it's still thriving after what is will be coming up to 36, 37 years this year.
What did hard work look like in the first 6 months to a year? Was it, you had more of a sales background, sales and buying
the sales I had was from the cattle markets. Mm-hmm. Which it's not exactly your standard sale. It's falling in with the local dealers and the mm-hmm. farmers and trying to get a stand and whatever. So it was probably more about pure relationships, I would say, rather than pure selling. To me, selling is not about the guy with the smart suit and tie and the smart talk. It's actually about being able to go and talk to people, build relationships. And any business, no matter what it is, it's ultimately about selling, and everybody in that business should be a salesperson, from the person that answers the phone to the person that drives the truck and delivers something. So I suppose I was always very, very keen on not just selling a product, but actually trying to build a relationship so that the person would continue to buy off me next week, next month, next year. And I think it's something that I did pretty successfully.
What about managing the business and the kind of operation side? Was it hard to do all of that at the start and sell?
It was. I think we started off with maybe one other person. I used to bring work home here at night. You'd be hand numbering sales dockets and whatever, and I'd have Eugenie sitting at the kitchen table banging out the numbers and whatever. So we did everything. I mean, it was literally a jack of all trades. You went in the morning and you cleaned up, you did the hoovering, you got ready for the day, you did some graphic design, you did some printing, you did some selling, you did some customer service, you did some accounts, you did some writing of checks, collecting money. Like, it was literally, it was an MBA in running a small business. I had no choice but to make it succeed, as I said earlier on. And as it grew, you were able to bring in, I suppose, more people. But I think the first salesperson that I actually got in the business was probably 10, 11 years after I opened. So wow. you just tended to do an awful lot yourself.
And what about then rolling out the franchise model and getting franchisees in? And when did that start? How successful was the first?
That started reasonably quickly. And initially, it was really probably family and friends. I mean, I think it was a little bit ironic, coming from the farming background, and my brother, sisters all born, reared onto the farm, into the kind of cattle business and whatever. And I ended up with two brothers and a sister who became franchise owners. Plus then there was people that I'd met through, say, Lansdowne Rugby Club. So people came to me for the franchise rather than I went to them. Mm-hmm. And I suppose one of the, seminal moments of Snap's history would have been around 1992, when I had to really make a decision whether we wanted to go into franchising in a very serious, big way, or we wanted to stay and just run it in a small manner. And I was making a lot of money out of my own Snap Centre, and I was really paying lip service maybe to the franchising end of things. And I came across a guy called Ed Murphy, who came on board as effectively director of franchising. Within a couple of years, Ed had become an equity partner, and within a couple of years after that, we'd become 50-50 partners in the franchising end of Snap. And we remained partners not only in Snap, but in other businesses, for the following 25 years. And we had this incredible relationship. You know, people will talk about partnerships and the risks of partnerships and the downsides of partnerships, but I couldn't speak highly enough of my relationship with Ed. We actually just became great friends and great partners. We had different strengths, but we could have a lot of arguments and a lot of differences without ever falling out, which really is probably the essence of a good partnership, that you can disagree but you don't actually make it personal. So Ed was a huge part of the continued success of Snap right through from 1992, 93 till the time that kind of we semi-exited, I suppose, in around 2006.
You said you had different strengths. Was there anything specifically that Ed had that you thought you lacked, or that you thought you didn't really want to deal with?
Ed was dogged. He's a good Wexford man, and he was dogged, right? If Ed wanted to do something, if he needed something to do, Ed would do it, and he would never take no for an answer. I would probably be a little bit more kind of shy, wouldn't be the right word, but maybe reluctant to kind of, if you didn't get in the front door, you go in the side door. If you went in the side door, you go in the back door. So Ed did everything, anything it would take to be successful, all within the rules, of course, but Ed would do it to be successful. Like, incredible drive, commitment, hard work. We had a lot in common, I would have thought, as well. But I think Ed had something kind of special, just in terms of, if it needed to be done, Ed would do it, and he'd find a way to do it. So I would have learnt a little bit from that as well.
And what about your own strengths? What did you find throughout the first few years, and even over the whole term, were your own strengths?
Sometimes difficult to talk about your strengths, I would say. But I think I had no choice but to work very hard at the time. So I think that was a key strength. When I got an opportunity to do business with a company, I was able to build a relationship with people at the top. I think obviously having staff and managing staff and keeping staff happy and keeping them loyal and looking after them, I think was a strength as well. You learn, you have strengths and weaknesses, everybody mm-hmm. does, if you know yeah. what I mean. So they were probably my kind of key strengths as such.
Were there any weaknesses that you thought you might have had, or that came to light throughout the period?
That's a good question. And again, people are reluctant to probably share their share their weaknesses, as you know. Yeah. I made lots of mistakes. I mean, I suppose a weakness was that I think it's something that when you become successful, that there is a danger that an element of cockiness, stroke, arrogance slips in. And that certainly happened to me, in that, you know, I was very good at certain things, but sometimes when you get very good at certain things, you think you can be very good at everything, and you can't be. So, and Ed probably suffered a little bit from that as well. So we went off on different tangents. We set up a dot-com business in 1999, 2000, and we lost pretty well everything that we'd ever made. So that was a shock to the system. We had to learn a lot of humility very quickly after that particular episode. Mm. We had to go back into Snap with our tail between our legs and pretty well start off again, which we did. But like, I suppose, entrepreneurs have got a good ability to put the past behind them as well. Learn from the past, but don't keep reflecting on the past, if you know what I mean. You've got to always look forward and learn from your mistakes. And to me, most people in business have made mistakes. Some will acknowledge them, others won't. But if you learn from them, they can be very good mistakes to make as such. So learn from that, and I think I learned a lot about due diligence as well. I would say that the biggest mistakes that I made right throughout my business career were down to a lack of due diligence, whereby you would see the opportunity, get excited about the opportunity, but you don't look at the downside. And you almost, not that you don't even want to look at it, you want to ignore it. And you don't want people to even point it out to you. You actually just want to be focused because you see an opportunity. So as the years kind of have gone on, I think I've become much better at actually looking at things from all sides rather than just the one side.
What was the .com business? What was the service, or what did it do?
Basically, it was a business called PrintOrigin.com, and it was effectively setting up a marketplace whereby we would recruit printers and customers, and it would be all done pretty well through the web. We put a lot of money into it ourselves. We raised a lot of money from private clients. Two and a half years later, when we burned through a lot of money, 9/11 happened, and then the market, so everything pretty well closed down for months after that, and we'd run out of money. So did it fail or did it run out of money? A little bit of both, really. There was a lot of hype back then. They talk about the dot-com bubble, right? This was so much part of the dot-com bubble, and I don't think no matter what we could have done, we would have really made it work at the end of the day. So it was a learning experience.
And what about the investors in that? How did you manage everything?
There was a number of private investors, most of whom I'd known, to be honest with you, and that made it even more difficult. And I remember at the time when we had made the decision that we were going to close down the company, I said, now, okay, so I've now got these 30 or 40 people that I know that have invested significant sums into this company. So what do I do? A lot of people would go and run for cover, and then some people would take it on the chin and actually be proactive. So I locked myself into a room one day and I took out the phone book and I rang every single one of them. It was probably the best thing that I ever did from a pure decision on how to handle a situation, how to handle failure, how to handle what could have been an incredibly stressful situation even to this day. So rang them all, and I think out of the probably 35, 40 people I rang, one person gave me a hard time over it. The rest all said, listen, we really appreciate the phone call. Shit happens. We drive on, move on. Good luck in the future. After I'd made those phone calls over 2-3 days, the stress relief of knowing that I can actually look these people in the eye the next time I see them, and them knowing that I rang them and made the effort to ring them, was a huge plus. And it's something that when I talk to people in business nowadays, that I would say that if you have situations that are causing you a lot of stress, try and deal with them as quickly as possible. Like, write down what you need to do. If you have to ring people, if you have to go somewhere, do something, meet someone, talk to somebody, whatever it is, do it if it's within your power to do it. If it's something that there's nothing you can do about it, well then just move on and put it to the back of your mind. So if you can influence the outcome of it or influence the stress, well then do something about it. If you can't, well then you got to program your mind to just say, sorry, did my best, can't do any more, move on and forget about it.
After a while, you built up Snap then after this big failure. And I suppose at some stage you got an interest in starting another business.
People talk then about, I talked to you about business planning earlier on and how Snap came about, and again, Homestead came out a little bit, somewhat maybe similar. And I believe that there is a major luck factor in life in general, and I think in business in general. People again mightn't acknowledge it, and they might like to put themselves forward as these geniuses that saw the future and decide this is what the way they were going to go. But in general, I would feel that there's a lot of luck involved. So Homestead, we got a phone call one day from the commercial department of the US Embassy. There was a lady in town who was representing Homestead, who were based out of Omaha, and they were looking for a master franchise or for Ireland, and would we meet her? And we met her. We were really impressed. It was myself and Ed Murphy again. Met her, really impressed. We got on a plane to Omaha, Nebraska. Within a week, we met the company, the people. We loved the company, we loved the people. We didn't have a clue about the business, by the way. We obviously no experience, nothing, but we actually loved the company and the people. And on St. Patrick's Day 2006, we signed the master franchise agreement for Homestead. Came back again, what the hell are we going to do now? We got stuck in. We set up the first office in Leopardstown. That became successful very quickly. Normally it would take 12 months for proof of concept in a franchise, and you'd run a pilot operation for 12 months to make sure that you can be successful and be profitable and show the figures, etc., etc. But we actually became successful very quickly in Home Instead. We sold three franchises on the same day in March 2007. They became really successful, and it kind of went from there. It became successful really quickly, and today, like, it's an incredible business, providing an incredible service for older people. So a really good, robust, worthwhile, needed business in Ireland.
And was it the market really that drove it, or how much of that was intent? Well, obviously it was intentional, but how much of it was your kind of strategy and work versus...
It's actually one of the very few businesses, Connor, that I know of that demand way exceeds supply. So the challenges in the business don't come from a sales point of view or getting clients. The demographics in Ireland are all in our favour, in that the population is getting older, the kind of over 65s, over 70s, over 80s are all increasing in size. They're all looking to stay at home. COVID has probably even reinforced the fact that people want to stay at home more. They want to live independently as long as possible. They don't really want to go into nursing homes or whatever. So everything really, I suppose, worked in our favour from that point of view. And we only, I suppose, we worked that out as we went along. The big challenges are finding enough caregivers to look after all the clients. Like, we probably employ about, I think it's 4,000 caregivers on a daily basis. So it's a big, big operation. But if we could find another 1,000 caregivers tomorrow, we'd have work for them as well.
Was it easier the second time round in terms of the work put in and figuring things out and your experience from what you had before?
Definitely. Yeah, because I think you've learned an awful lot. I think initially, again, like I bought the master franchise for Snap, and I was 28 years of age. I had one kid on the way, and I'm looking at kids today, and I'm saying, I'd say they're a bit flabbergasted that you could actually go to Australia, come back with a master franchise, set it all, boom, 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 at 28 years of age. So, like, I was very much a rookie back then, and the experience that I gained over the following 20 years would have been very beneficial in terms of setting up Home Instead. Even in terms, I think, of the franchising aspect of it, and how you look after the franchisees, the quality of the service that you give them, the relationships that you have with them. You're just so much better at everything. Like, at 28, you don't know a huge amount, really, and you're learning it as you go along. Whereas 20 years later, you've been through the mill in most ways, in terms of the highs and lows and success and failure of business. Yeah.
What are the benefits of having a franchise versus starting from scratch with a similar concept?
Well, proof, I think, is number one. I think that's probably the key thing. And the statistics will say that kind of 4 out of 5 businesses will fail within the first 4 years or so, whereas 4 out of 5 franchises will succeed within the first 4 or 5 years. So there is a big, I think, benefit from franchising in terms of obviously having a brand initially, number one, having a proven concept, number two, having a business in a box, I suppose, that you know exactly what you should do in given circumstances. I think that there are good franchises and bad franchises out there. And I talk to people kind of every week about franchising, and they come up with ideas, and I say, well, have you really thought about how much money you can actually make out of this? And I say, well, is it that low or whatever? So there's Home Instead, for instance, is a high grossing franchise, in that the franchisees will have revenues of 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, right? Whereas some franchises, you might only have revenues of 200,000. Mm-hmm. So the opportunity to make big money in some of those smaller franchises, it's very difficult without actually having, say, multiple coffee shops or multiple whatever it is, right? Whereas in a Home Instead or a Snap, the revenues are high enough that you can actually make good money. But ultimately, it boils down to the quality of the franchisees. Like, you know, it's fine to buy a franchise, but if the franchisee isn't a good operator, if he's not willing to work hard, if he's not willing to follow the system, that franchise probably has a chance of failing. But you have a much better chance of success, I think, as a franchise than you would as a non-franchise business.
What at the start, when you're meeting a potential franchisee, what are the things you look for? How do you know that the person's, or how do you have a good How do you kind of have the probabilities in your favour that the person's going to do well rather than fail?
I'd look at the personality, I think, number one. So they fit in with us and we fit in with them, because it is kind of going to be a long lasting relationship, and you want to make sure that you get on and that you like the people. So I think looking at that whole relation thing is really important. My kind of attitude towards interviewing franchises would be, I'm not going to sell you this. That would be my default position. It doesn't suit you, you're not good enough, whatever. And I would really get them to really, really want to sell themselves to me before I would make up my mind. Whereas in a number of franchises, you come with a check and they take you on. Whereas I was always of the view that we would try and put people off. And I'd always say to them, if I say no to you as an applicant, I'm actually doing you a big favour. Because what I'm saying is, I don't think you're suitable for this business. And I know what works in franchising at this stage. And that's kind of worked, I think, for us pretty well, by and large. You still make the odd mistake, but I think when you're dealing with people, you're always going to make mistakes.
Is there a lot of work that goes into getting a franchise successful in the first few years?
The first 12 months is critical, I would say, that they need lots of support. You know, you need quality training. Like, for instance, you take Home Instead, for instance, all our franchisees, we would insist that they would go to Omaha and spend a week or 10 days out there going through, I suppose, the American system and how they do things, the training that they do, the basic kind of philosophy of the company, the procedures, policies, etc. Then they would come back to Ireland and we'd place them with an existing franchisee, again for a period of maybe 2 weeks. We then maybe bring them into head office and we do more training with them. So all in all, there's probably maybe at least a month of training, real hard work training, before they'd open up. And then when they open up, we would then send somebody out to hold their hand a little bit, go out on some calls with them if they're going to meet the local public health nurse at the HSE office or whoever it is. Well, then go and visit with them and show them how it's done. Let them do the talking, but then maybe critique them afterwards and say, well, you did that really well, you didn't do that so well. So training would be a huge part of it. And then ongoing, you know, meetings and marketing and ongoing training, you know, whatever it takes, really, you'll actually do. I think one of the long-term benefits that franchisees get is the relationship that they have with each other. I suppose teamwork going among the franchisees and getting them to learn from each other and help each other and come up with their own innovative ideas that you may or may not take on board. I think that's a huge part of it as well, because you very much feel part of a team, and business generally can be a lonely place for the CEO stroke owner.
Did you have a different role in Snap versus Home Instead? Were you more of a head office capacity in Home Instead?
I would say, in all fairness, in Snap I would have been, you know, very much in terms of the centre that I owned, which was one of the top two or three of all the centres in Ireland and all the centres in Australia. And really, it required all my attention, because it was busy, it had a big turnover, it had, you know, I think 24, 25 people working there at its peak. So it was, that took a lot of my attention. So I was much more of a micromanager when I was in Snap as such. In Home Instead, I would give Ed Murphy the vast majority of the credit for getting Home Instead from effectively zero up to almost a 70 million turnover. So I was very much more, I suppose, working alongside Ed and looking at more, I suppose, strategizing and looking at the bigger picture stuff, rather than being down in the weeds and doing the day-to-day nitty-gritty, micromanaging, etc., etc.
Was it more enjoyable the second time?
Much more enjoyable, yes. Yeah. Required an awful lot less work for a start.
Yeah.
I suppose it allowed me to do things that I probably would never have had the opportunity to do if I was down kind of at a micromanagement level in Home Instead.
Such as becoming manager of the Irish rugby team?
Such as that, exactly, yeah.
So how did that come about?
That came about, again, and I suppose, you know, you talk about, I'd be a big believer in goal setting and you know, if you really want something, but then you got to work at it. It just doesn't come into your lap. And I was very involved in Lansdowne Rugby Club for many years, did everything from kind of director of rugby to president to chairman and whatever. And then around 2006, 2007, I was chairman of the club, and my brother, who you would be very familiar with, Connor, John, was coming in as president. So I looked at this scenario and I said, well, if John is going to be president and I'm going to be chairman, this ain't going to work. I said, not going to be good for anybody, including the club. So I decided then that I would step away completely, right? Give John a free run. Okay, and I just step away. So I stepped away, and then one day I met Enda McNulty, who has been the mental skills coach for the Irish team, worked with Leinster, great guy, works with a lot of big companies. I met Enda, this is back in probably 2008, and Enda said, well, you know, what would you like to do? And I said, well, I wouldn't mind getting involved in rugby in a different way. So team management obviously came up. And so I said, okay, well, I'm going to look at that. So within a week or two, I met Mick Dawson, CEO of Leinster. The person who was managing the Leinster under 20 team at the time was stepping down. And Mick said, will I take that on? So I took that on. So I started literally at the, not the bottom rung, but I started well down the rung. And then the following year, the role of Irish under 20 team manager came up, and I took that on. And then 2 years later, Paul McNaughton was stepping down from the senior role after the 2011 World Cup, and I put my name in the hat for that. And again, it happened. So that's how that came about.
Was there an interview process to get the senior job?
There was, yeah.
How did that go?
Well, it obviously went very well. Well, it did. Yeah. It went okay, yeah. They asked some pretty hairy questions. But I think the fact that I'd spent a couple of years with the under-20s was very helpful, because I did two World Cups with them, one in Argentina and one in Italy, which involved me in a way for, you know, 4 or 5 weeks at a time. So I actually knew that I was very comfortable in a team environment. I knew that I could manage people reasonably well from a business point of view. I could bring some maybe business thinking into the role as well. I was pretty comfortable, although it was a big step up from the under-20s to the senior team. It was like going from kindergarten to leaving cert in one fell swoop. That was interesting. Started out with Declan Kidney, working with Declan for two Six Nations, which was a difficult time. Post that World Cup in 11, the team kind of really wasn't doing well, didn't perform well, went on a tour to New Zealand, should have won a second test, didn't, and then got absolutely hockeyed in the third test, which was difficult. The following year, we lost to Scotland, lost to Italy. So that was a tricky, tricky time, and it wasn't... People talk and say, oh, listen, you had a great time, you had great success, whatever. But it wasn't. It's like everything else. There's no such thing as success. There's always failure somewhere along the way. So those couple of years were difficult. And then Joe Schmidt obviously took over from Declan in 2014, did an absolutely magnificent job with the whole team, the environment. Everything about Joe was top class. But it was tough work. Like, it wasn't, you know, some of it is... What the public see is the match days and success, but they don't see what goes on in the background from a Monday to Friday or winter days out in Carton House. Or the success you have makes up for the slog of actually the weekly grind that you go through, because I would have been very much embedded with the team full time right through those 5 years that I did.
What does success look like in the role in terms of what do you need to accomplish?
Well, ultimately, I think when you're involved in professional sport, success is actually... measured by your win-loss ratio. That's the bottom line. So I could be doing the best job in the world, but if the team isn't winning, well then that's failure. So it is very much a success is based on results. The success of a coach is based on the results. He could be brilliant and he could be doing a great job, but if he isn't getting results, well then that's only going to lead to one outcome at the end of the day.
What were there ways that you found you might be able to contribute to the success, even indirectly?
Well, I mean, I think the whole kind of organisation of the week and building relationships with players and, you know, I suppose talking to players and being a bit of a sounding board for players away from the coaches, it's hard to probably put your finger on exactly what you could do that made that more successful. It's probably a number of little things. It was making sure that nothing went wrong. If you're solving problems, well then it means that you have a problem. So you actually you try and avoid problems. So I would have been very much into problem avoidance. So like every Monday morning, I would sit down with the different team or management members, whether it be, you know, kit or commercial or logistics or whatever. And we ended up, I think, with a checklist of about 100 things that we had to make sure were right for the week. And you literally go to them every Monday and tick them all off. So I would like to think that avoidance of problems was one of the things that I actually became bloody good at. Under Joe, if you had a problem, you had a real problem. So you had to be very much on the ball. There was no room for any type of sloppiness, either on or off the pitch. Everything had to be nailed down.
So it was really a full-time job when you moved into it?
Very much so, yeah. Yeah, like when you were in camp, it was full-time. And even out of camp, you'd be meeting up with Joe every week or so to discuss different things. And you were always on call, I suppose, at the end of the day. But it was a real passion of mine, so I never felt... While it was hard work, I never really felt it was kind of hard work as such. It was because I was so much... I loved the game, I loved the role, I loved being involved with the team, probably kept me young as well, mixing with all these young fellas that were causing a little bit of trouble now and again. So it was great. It was an experience, I think, that was a real privilege at the end of the day.
Was that your favourite part about it, being part of the community there with the first team?
Yeah, man, first team and the management, you know. Mm-hmm. like I'd still be very friendly with the likes of Joe Schmidt to this day. To be in regular touch with Les Kiss, who was there before Joe as a coach, backed in a little bit with the team now, and I'm getting on really well with Andy Farrell. So there's a management team of 23, 24 people that have actually been pretty consistent really from back 2012, and I get on really well, made some great friends along the way. Player-wise, I'd get on very well with them as well, and some of the guys that maybe have retired since, I do a bit of mentoring with them. So I would have maintained really good relationships, met a lot of great people, obviously saw the inside of a professional team, and the environment was just a great thing to see and learn about.
Did you have people you learned from throughout, you know, Snap, Home Instead, and managing the Irish rugby team? Did you have people that had maybe been there before, or that might have been able to guide you when things got tough?
I had a couple of people, yeah, that I'd use as a kind of a sounding board. I'm always a good believer that if you're playing around with something in your mind and you're not sure about something, you're always better off to ask somebody that you trust, am I on the right track here, or is there any alternative view? So I'd have probably two or three people that I would ring up at the time and say, listen, I have a problem here, I have a problem there, this is how I'm thinking of solving it, what's your view on it? I always like people to come to me with solutions and then maybe sense check the solution, rather than people coming to me looking for the solution from the off as such. You know, talking about mentors and whatever, like Paddy Thompson to me probably was the guy that probably changed my whole direction in life and such, because if I hadn't met Paddy, I wouldn't have got into Snap. If I hadn't got into Snap, I wouldn't have come back to Ireland.
Will you be involved in rugby in the future? Are you still involved in rugby?
Still involved. I'm on the board of EPCR, which is the European Professional Club Rugby, runs the Heineken Cup and the Challenge Cup, potentially will run a Club World Cup over the next couple of years. So that's a kind of a stimulating, interesting role that I've been on for the last couple of years. I sit on the National Game Board in Ireland as well, which is interesting. So it keeps me kind of up to speed. And then for last year's Six Nations and going on, I've been involved with the team for a couple of days a week, really acting as a mentor to the players and a sounding board for players and management.
Do you ever get an itch to start another business?
Absolutely not. I've started a few in my day, Connor, and no, I don't. It's funny. Like I sit on the board of Snap. I sit on the board of a medical supplies company called PEI. I sit on the National Game Board, the board of EPCR. So like I've plenty to do, and like I reckon it's interesting in that I felt I would have started work. You start work when you're 8 or 9 or 10 years of age. But I really probably started working when I was 18 years of age, and I worked really hard up until I was 62 or 3 years of age. So I don't feel that I need to go back and do something again.
Has it been a nice change of pace since stepping back from the big responsibilities?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. I've really enjoyed just the time, I suppose, and the time to... It's not the time to do nothing, it's just the time to do things that you really want to do. Mm-hmm. You know, play a bit of golf, do a lot of exercise, go to the gym, meet up with people. We have a house down in Lahinch, so I go down there quite a bit, do a bit of travel. So it's nice to do things that you like doing. I'd say probably 10 or 12 people, so I meet them every quarter. That's giving back something, really. I don't do it as a paying job as such. I just do it because I feel that people were very good to me throughout my career, and if I can help people be a little bit successful themselves and help them along the way, well, then I'm delighted to do that.
And is that very structured, or does it work in the same way as they'll come to you with potential
solutions? No, it's pretty structured. Basically, what I do is I'd have an initial meeting with them. I'd let them know how it works. I'd get them comfortable that that's what they'd like to do, right? I then get them to set a number of goals in different areas of their life. So business would be one, family and friends would be two, health and fitness would be three, personal development would be four, and giving would be five. So they'd come back to me then maybe a week later and they'd have their goals set out in this particular area. That effectively would form the agenda for the next meeting. So how did you do in your goals? Mm-hmm. And I challenge them on their goals as well. They wouldn't be soft goals, they'd be goals that I figured would make them improve. Mm-hmm. And in fairness to them, a lot of people buy into it, and if they don't buy into it, we just say, that's fine. You know, so it's not a, you know, it's onerous in that kind of, if I meet them after 3 months and they've done nothing, but then I say, listen, we're wasting our time here, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
But generally, people that are doing it get great benefit out of that particular thing to do as well, like, you know, so it's good.
Mick Carney, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Very welcome, Connor. Good to chat to you.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Our team of qualified accountants leverage the power of cloud technology to automate your manual processes and cut the cost of your finance function in half. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others to find the show. I'm your host, Connor Carney. Thanks for listening.